I think The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, for my own money, is the most artistically successful of the books.
And when you read The Silver Chair, you notice how very wet a book it is.
I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com, and this is All About Jack, a podcast feature of that site. As you can probably tell, today the focus of my program is on the third and fourth published books from the Chronicles of Narnia. If you listened to the last show I posted, then you know I've been re-releasing a series spotlighting a book from Dr. Michael Ward called The Narnia Code. Originally, that series from 2012 was posted over a 13-week span, but I decided to combine two or three of those shows this time around. Dr. Holly Ordway from Houston Baptist University joins me again as co-host, along with, of course, Dr. Michael Ward. He is the special guest. Please consider catching the other two combined shows either before or after listening to this podcast to best understand Dr. Ward's approach. The first repackaged show combines the three introductory chapters of the book and last time the initial two Narnia books were explored. Now, even though I'm doing a chapter-by-chapter look at the Narnia Code, please consider this as more of a summary or sharing highlights from the book and get a copy of it yourself to more completely appreciate the material. As noted, the third and fourth published books, Voyage of the Dawn Treader and The Silver Chair, are examined today. The original shows are separated by a brief musical transition.
So we've been going through the various chapters of the Narnia Code with one podcast per chapter, and we're only touching on a few highlights. So I do encourage you to get the book if this has intrigued you, because there's lots more good things in there that you can read and appreciate. And in this particular episode, we are looking at The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which actually is my favorite after The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So one of the things that we can see in this is the imagery of the sun as the dominant influence in it. And this is connected with a number of different themes that might not at first seem to be connected with the sun, but in fact are. And one of them is the imagery of dragons.
Yes, absolutely. And again, this was not something I knew about before I began researching this into this theme. But the sun and dragons were very closely connected in Greek mythology in particular. And Lewis, who grew up with a very detailed and extensive classical education, would have known about this from the age of 7 onwards. I mean, it's pathetic how my education was so weak on the classics that I didn't know about this until I was in my 30s. But Lewis grew up imbibing this almost with his mother's milk. And in Homer's hymn to Apollo, for instance, Apollo is the sun god, the god of light. And he kills a dragon called Python in a very notable, memorable episode. And if you look at that episode in Homer and then compare it with the way Lewis describes Aslan's undragoning of Eustace, you see some clear connections and allusions. So Aslan in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is the solar spirit, the sun god, if you like, the true soul. When he kills Eustace's dragonishness, ripping off the thick, dark, knobbly hide, he is again manifesting solar characteristics. It's not just when he's golden and illuminating that Aslan is solar, it's also when he kills dragons.
One of the things, Michael, that you note is that in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, an entire chapter is devoted to a theme related to alchemy. Why does Lewis seem to do that?
Yes, alchemy, the turning of base metal into gold, was a science or an activity particularly associated with the sun. It was thought that the sun's very influence brought gold into being by penetrating Earth's crust and turning base metals into gold. Each of the planets was associated with a different metal, and the sun's was gold. So, in that chapter in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, where they come to Goldwater Island, you see this very explicitly focused upon. They discover the statue, what seems to be a statue, a golden statue, lying in the bottom of this pool, and they realize after a while that it's one of the lost lords who's dived into this pool and been turned into gold, and as a result has died. And as soon as they realize that they've got this magic pool on their doorstep, they begin quarreling because they realize that it can make them fabulously rich. And it almost comes to a fight between Caspian and Edmund. At that point, Aslan appears, shining as if in bright sunlight on the hill opposite them. We're told that the sun has in fact gone in, but Aslan is shining as if in bright sunlight, and his very presence shames them into silence. He doesn't say anything, just the sight of him is enough to make them realize that he is the true gold. He is the thing that is much to be desired, yea, more than much fine gold, to quote the scriptures. And as a result, they give up their battle over this Goldwater pool, and in fact they change its name to Deathwater, because they realize that it's just causing them to be avaricious and covetous. The true love of gold is a love that is directed towards Aslan himself, who is the sun of righteousness, the light of the world.
So that's emphasis on Aslan as light, and the light of the world is part of what you talk about as the generally Johannine quality of the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, that it has more of a feel of the Gospel of John than any of the other chronicles specifically. And we see that, for instance, in the ending, but we also see that, I think, in some of the imagery woven throughout the book. Do you want to unfold that a little bit?
Yes, you're right. I mean, in that very episode I was just talking about, actually, when they see Aslan on the hillside, we're then told that nobody dared to ask what it was. They knew it was Aslan. And that's a deliberate echo of John 21:12. None of the disciples dared ask, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. And there's another allusion to John's Gospel later in the book, when they see the white lamb on the beach, and he says to them, "Come and have breakfast." And that's another allusion to John 21, where Jesus says exactly the same to the disciples, "Come and have breakfast," after the resurrection. And then later on in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, you've got another allusion to John 21, when Edmund says to Aslan, are you there in our world too, sir?" So yes, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is a much more poetic book in some ways than the first two Narnia Chronicles. Aslan floats in and out of this story in very intense moments of reproof and prayer and conversion in the case of Eustace. He's not like the Aslan who romps cheek by jowl with the children in the first two books. He's got a much more transcendent quality to him, golden and illuminating and bringing wisdom and insight. And this atmosphere or flavour is very skillfully woven into the whole book. I think The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, for my own money, is the most artistically successful of the books. It's absolutely a genius work, I think. It and the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe are, if you ask me, the two greatest of the Narnia Chronicles. I mean, they're all good, but these two are especially good, I think.
You were just making reference to poetry in terms of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader book itself, but in this chapter discussing it, you note that the lack of familiarity with Jack's poetry is a reason for not noticing the theme of the sun in this very book, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Lewis's poetry is not very well known, but if you do read it, you see that in quite a number of his poems, he actually uses solar symbolism and talks about alchemy and the transmutation of metals. There are a number of poems like Noon's Intensity, for instance, and The Pageant Played in Vain, one or two others as well. And when you see these poems in which Lewis very explicitly uses solar symbolism, then when you turn to The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, episodes like that episode on Goldwater Island become much more explicable. You know, it's not just a convenient lesson in not being avaricious. It's not just a morality message that Lewis is wanting to convey. The point is that this symbolism is connected to the whole structure of the book, at the level of the trajectory of the plot, at the level of the portrayal of Aslan, and in all sorts of ornamental details as well. It's a very sophisticated yet subtle and accessible use of Lewis's great learning and breadth of reading. But because he manages to turn it into such a readable story, we tend to think, oh, it's just It's just simple. It's just a kid's story. It doesn't have any great artistry behind it. And nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, Michael, one of the episodes that's really interesting and might not seem to fit right away is the bit with the monopods. Would you want to...
Oh, yes, the duffelpods.
Yes.
The podimons. They can't decide what they're called, can they? These ridiculous creatures with one large foot, they think they're very ugly, so they've been made invisible, and now they can't bear being invisible, so they want to be made visible again. You know, they're very stupid. They're constantly changing their mind. They're ridiculous in the extreme. And it's a very charming episode. It's very amusing. But it might seem to be a little bit out of kilter with the rest of the book. Unless you realize that another thing that the sun was particularly associated with in Lewis's imagination was the bringing of wisdom. And in the characters of the monopods, we have these foolish duffers who are totally unreceptive to solar wisdom. The chief duffer's daughter is named Clipsy, which comes from the word. If you look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary, Clipsy means under eclipse, dark. These are characters who are not open to the sun. Their minds are closed. They are foolish. They are silly. So they are the opposite of true solar characters. And in all the Narnia books, that's what Lewis does. He gives you both characters who respond correctly to Aslan and his influence, and he gives you characters who don't. In Prince Caspian, we noticed the hag and the werewolf and the Telmarines who don't become martial. The true faithful Narnians do become truly martial. And we'll see that in all of the books, that there are opposites. There are people who fail to become like Aslan's spirit. And the duffers, the silly, laughable duffers, are just that in this story.
And one other bit that we might not want to lose track of is the fact that in this book, we actually get an instance of looking along the beam, which in a way expresses Lewis's entire way of composing the Chronicles. We actually get an instance of it.
Absolutely. Looking along the beam is a phrase that we find in Lewis's essay, Meditation in a Tool Shed. We discussed this in an earlier episode. You can look at something from the outside, or you can look along it from the inside. And that very phrase, looking along the beam, is to be found in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, when the ship is lost in a dark island, and Lucy prays a desperate prayer for help to Aslan to come and rescue them. And then she finds a beam of light falling upon the ship. And then we read, Lucy looked along the beam. Those very words appear in this story. And as she looks along the beam, she sees what seems to be at first a cross, then it turns into a kite, then into an aeroplane, and finally it becomes an albatross. And this albatross flies close to her and whispers in a lovely, sweet, reassuring voice, "Courage, dear heart," and she knows that this is Aslan. So there we have a prime example of looking along the beam, of immersing yourself in a way of thinking, a way of feeling, a way of knowing. And as you immerse yourself in it and focus upon it more and more intently, you see more and more about Christ. First of all, he's just the cross, then he's a kite, then he's got some kind of motion to him because he's an aeroplane, and finally he becomes organic and beautiful. He's this bird, this albatross. Coleridge in The Rime of the Ancient Mariner made the albatross into a symbol of Christ, and Lewis does just exactly the same here. And this is what happens to Lucy when she looks along the beam, when she commits herself to living within this spiritual framework. And that's, again, one of the large-scale purposes that Lewis had in mind for this planetary symbolism. In each book, as you look along the beam of Mars or Jupiter or the Sun, you become increasingly jovial or martial or solar. You get to know Aslan better and you become more like him.
Well, thank you very much for unfolding these interesting things about the sun. But we've been focusing just on the Narnia Code so far and the Planet Narnia books. So would you tell us a little bit more about the other scholarship that you've done?
Yes, another big thing I've been involved in is the Cambridge Companion to C.S. Lewis. That was a book that came out in 2010. It consists of 21 chapters by different scholars from all over the world assessing different parts of Lewis's output. That was a very big project, which I was very honoured to be involved in. I co-edited that with my friend Robert McSwain from the University of the South in Tennessee. And I would heartily recommend that to anybody who's interested in Lewis. Another book I've recently contributed to is a book called Imaginative Apologetics, which you, Holly, being an exponent of Christian apologetics, know all about. And I wrote about C.S. Lewis's apologetics in that book, Imaginative Apologetics, edited by Andrew Davison.
And as we wrap up here, let me just add something that Holly noted in a previous podcast, and that is Dr. Ward's original book, Planet Narnia, of course, is a book of scholarship, and then he is a good like Lewis in terms of being able to make something that's really more complex and make it easier for the everyday person to understand, which is what he did with the Narnia Code. And I know when I was going back over the material preparing for the podcast, I was even more convinced about Michael's perspective and that he presents in the Narnia Code. And for those who are listening, they're going, I can see certain parts. I would encourage you to go back and listen to these episodes again and, of course, to buy either of the book, Planet Narnia, or the Narnia Code. Michael, it's episode 7 next time. What do we deal with in the next podcast?
We're looking at the Silver Chair, which is all about the moon and wetness and wanderings and lunacy.
I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. Thanks for listening in to part 7 of the Narnia Code podcast series. We are now up to the 4th Narnia book in publication order, The Silver Chair, and I must say that when I first read the Chronicles, this was in some ways my favorite. Now, some people may call me crazy for picking it, and I think that after reading Dr. Ward's book, I found out that I was possibly under the influence of the moon. Does all that sound confusing? Well, stay tuned and it will be much clearer. Well, as noted, The Silver Chair is our focus. Your title in this chapter is Mirror or Moonshine, and it starts out with a verse from Scripture in Psalm 121 about the moon not harming us. And you pose the question, how can the moon hurt us? Will you tell us what your answer is to that?
Yes, this verse from Psalm 121 says, the sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. And it's pretty obvious how the sun can hurt us by making us dehydrated or giving us sunburn or skin cancer or something like that. But how can the moon hurt us by night? And that's because of the old belief that the moon had an influence over the earth and over people, over events and even the metals in earth's crust. And the moon could make you mentally unstable, really. That was the main quality or attribute associated with the moon, that she would turn your wits, make you into a lunatic. And in the New Testament, it's not just in the Psalms, but in the New Testament too, we find this idea of lunacy when Jesus, in Matthew's Gospel, heals lunatics on at least two occasions. Matthew 4 and Matthew 17, you find that. Quite a lot of modern translations render lunatic as epileptic, but that's a very questionable translation. If you look at the original Greek, the word used in the Greek translation of the New Testament is that these people are selenized. They are under the influence of Selene, who was one of the goddesses associated with the moon. So it's very much a lunar disease, as it were, that these people are thought to be suffering from when Jesus heals them. So it's that kind of thing which the scriptural writers have in mind when they talk about being harmed by the moon at night.
Right, so that gives us a good idea of the idea of the moon as being dangerous, potentially unhealthy, or rendering people unstable. And clearly Lewis is picking that up in The Silver Chair. But he's also connecting it with the medieval idea of changeability, with the idea of being under the moon. And that actually plays out in the book as well. I wonder if you might unpack that a little bit.
Yes, the changeability is not just the changeability of the wits of your mental state. It's also a general kind of mutability that is associated with the moon. Because the moon waxes and wanes, ebbs and flows, you might say, moves about the sky very quickly, gets larger, gets smaller, changes color from time to time. Of all the seven heaven, of all the seven planets, the moon is the most changeable. So she was thought to be responsible for all sorts of changeability and instability, and in particular with the instability of water, because it was known that there was this connection between the moon and the tides. So wetness, moisture,
all sorts of watery qualities are associated with the lunar influence. And when you read The Silver Chair, you notice how very wet a book it is. And interestingly, it's wet even before the characters get to Narnia. Even the English scenes at the beginning of the book are very wet. Jill is found crying on a damp little path, and Eustace sits on the wet grass, and the water drops drip off the laurel leaves, and so on and so forth. So right from the very first page of the book, Lewis is trying to conjure this atmosphere of lunar qualities. And Puddleglum, when he turns up, he's described, his very name suggests wateriness, and he belongs to a race of marsh wiggles who do all the watery work in Narnia. And he's three times described as a wet blanket. He's constantly predicting wet afternoons and rain coming on. And when you look, you suddenly realize that this story is absolutely drenched in water from beginning to end.
And we can even see the way that he uses that theme to stitch in some of the more medieval references, like the witch, when we first hear about her, she's the lady by the fountain, and of course she's changeable because she's the woman and she's the snake.
Yes. Yes, and she's also green, the green lady, the lady of the green kirtle. And that's because another thing associated with the moon was envy. Shakespeare talks about the moon's vestal livery, which is green, pale and green with envy. And the moon was thought to be an envious planet, or at any rate capable of producing envy in people, because the moon's light is entirely derived. The moon has no light of her own. The moon only shines because the sun shines on her. So she's got this kind of secondary status, as it were, produces no light directly from herself. So it became imagined that she might be unsatisfied with this secondary status. And that's why I've called this chapter Mirror or Moonshine, because according to Lewis's understanding of all these lunar qualities, the moon is only truly happy when she is a mirror, when she most fully reflects the sun's light. That is what she does. She rules the night by virtue of her reflecting of the sun's light. But there's this alternative understanding of her qualities in a negative sense, that she's just moonshine. And when Lewis uses the word moonshine, he always uses that term to suggest something which is nonsensical, idle nonsense. It's unbelievable. Something that is moonshine is something which is somehow fake. If you believe that the moon shines of her own light, then that is a deceit, that is a confusion. So the moon is a very ambiguous planet, maybe the most ambiguous of the seven medieval symbols. And that's one of the reasons why, in this story, Aslan doesn't appear in Narnia at all. Aslan is confined to his own high country above the clouds. And he blows Jill and Eustace down into Narnia and says, take care that the air does not confuse your mind. The air will thicken when you get down into Narnia. But Aslan is above all that. He's up in his own high country where there's not a breath of wind. It's very still. It's very solid. And that's because of this association in medieval thought with the idea that the moon was at the boundary between the two realms, the realm of ether and immutability, certainty, fixity, and the realm of the sublunary, the realm of air and confusion and doubt and uncertainty. And that's why you have this feature of the structure of the book, that Aslan is only seen at the beginning and the end above the realm of uncertainty.
I want to drop back for a second. This is not really a question. Even though I've always enjoyed astronomy, the planets, and such growing up, for some reason when I was, you know, going through this chapter, you know, the expression about moonshine and what it obviously meant, I guess, was just so routine that I didn't think about it anymore. And that, obviously, as you were noting, the moon doesn't shine on its own, but I think we kind of lose sight of that because we don't think about it, just as you note in your book about, we don't tend to think about the planets, the stars, the heavens, because we have so many distractions. That's probably another chapter here that we're going to get to before too long. But I think that's important to underscore that, you know, moonshine is this nonsense or stupidity. That's one of the characteristics. But in terms of a question, though, you were noting in this chapter about the two lunatics in the Silver Chair. I wonder if you would take a moment to discuss that.
Yes, well, the main lunatic is the lost prince, Prince Rillian, who is the object of the quest. Where is this lost prince? He's in this underworld kingdom, and he's found locked up, chained to a silver chair. Obviously, it's a silver chair, because silver is the metal of the moon. And he's found raving like a lunatic, 1 hour in every 24. Or at any rate, that's what he believes. He says to the adventurers that there comes upon me 1 hour every night when I lose my wits, when I'm raving and in a frenzy. And then I am very dangerous, he says, and you must not do anything I tell you during that hour. But actually, and this is the ingenious thing, that hour is his only hour of sanity, and it's the rest of the time that he is actually a lunatic. But it's the function of his lunacy that he doesn't know this. So there's this brilliant scene when he finally gets to his hour of sanity, and it's during that hour that he begs Puddle Glum and Jill and Eustace to free him from his bonds, and he asks them to do so in the name of Aslan, and that is the fourth sign, and it's the only sign that they correctly follow. So he's one lunatic, and then the other lunatic is the headmistress of Experiment House, this school where Jill and Eustace are pupils. At the end of the story, when Jill and Eustace come back from Narnia and Aslan makes a brief appearance, she herself loses her wits. She's found raving like a lunatic, we're told, and then there's an inquiry into the school, and they discover that she's not a very good headmistress, so she becomes an inspector of other schools, and she's not even very good at that, so eventually they get her into the House of Parliament, where she lives happily ever after. So Lewis is having a lot of fun there at the expense of this lunatic headmistress. And it's all part of the moon influence running throughout the story. It's a brilliantly artistic way of tying all these different threads in the story together.
So one of the things that we might miss as readers is this idea, when we think about changeability and under the moon and above the moon, is that when we think of the medieval view of the cosmos as being Earth-centered, we tend to automatically assume that that makes Earth the most important and the most, say, perfect, but actually the view is that it gets more perfect as you're going up closer to going further up, and that actually the Earth is the realm of imperfection, and that all the kind of the imperfections are under the moon. As you look up and out, you see order and perfection, and you see disorder close to home.
Yes.
And this is such a reversal of, well, first of all, how moderns tend to think of medieval thought, because it's highly stereotyped and misunderstood, but also I think a reversal in some ways of the way that we think about the world. And so I think there's some interesting things that we can kind of draw out of that.
Yes. No, and that again is part of the structure of the silver chair, that the lower down you get, the more you're likely to be confused. So Jill and Eustace are blown down into Narnia, and they're told that the air will thicken, and they must keep repeating the signs to themselves, because things will be confusing down there. But then they go even further down. They go into the witch's kingdom, this underworld kingdom, where they feel suffocated, where there seems to be not enough air to breathe, even. And down there, the witch tries to convince them that there is no overworld. And that when they say, yes, but there is, we've seen the sun up there. And she says, what is this sun? And in trying to explain the sun, they point to the lamp hanging from the ceiling. But the witch tries to pretend that they're just projecting from the lamp to this notional idea of a fictitious sun. And it's a brilliant dramatization, really, of the ontological argument for the existence of God, actually. Lewis writes about that in a letter to someone. But anyway, we're talking about getting further down and getting more central, and the underworld is not even the most lowly or central country in this story, because below Underland is this realm of Bism, where the gnomes live, a realm of pure rock and living jewels, and you get a glimpse down into Bism, but you don't actually get there, unfortunately, in this story. But Lewis was interested in gnomes and rock life and whether there are indeed, you know, spirits of rock and geology. He wrote a long poem about that very subject, The True Nature of Gnomes, a brilliant poem.
I wanted to pick up something here, though, which is the thread of memory and obedience, because he Lewis sets up so well, this structure, this almost this reverse argument, because we as readers know that the upper world, the overworld is real. We know that. We know that Aslan is real. And so when we see the characters being baffled by the witch, we're saying, no, no, it's real, it's real.
Yes.
But really this is identical to the argument that is made to Christians to say, well, you're just making this stuff up, basically.
Yes.
And so one of the things that you'd mentioned in the Narnia Code is the way that Lewis weaves in the role of memory and obedience, and that's really directly applicable to how we're sorting out how we as Christians deal with being in the muddled world where people are trying to tell us, no, you're just making this stuff up.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It's a brilliantly structured book when you think about it, The Silver Chair, because we've seen these characters in the overworld, in Narnia, and then we can see straight through the witch's deceit when she tries to convince them otherwise down in her kingdom. But of course, the Narnian world is not the only overworld, because there is Aslan's country above Narnia. So there's a kind of a threefold tier system going on in this book. Aslan's country, Narnia, the witch's kingdom, and then this brief glimpse down to Bism. And each world looks up and has to exercise faith, really, in order to perceive the higher world. Because the higher world can only be understood properly from within, or from above, but not from below. But by memory, by obedience, by faith, you can perceive something of the higher world. And that's what Jill and Eustace have to, and Puddle Glum have to exercise as the story goes on.
Well, as timekeeper, I must step in and say that's going to be where we're going to have to end our discussion of Chapter 7. And if you have a good working knowledge of C.S. Lewis's Narnia stories, then you know that the next published book is The Horse and His Boy. Michael, as we close here, what's the fastest summary, given the spirit of what you're going to talk about, that you can give us about what we'll have?
The Horse and His Boy is about Mercury. That's my fastest summary.
And those who are familiar with what Mercury stands for will understand that.
That's how the main part of that episode ended. You've been listening to the 6th and 7th program from a series examining the Narnia Code. I'm William O'Flaherty, and this is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Be sure to listen next time, as I'm combining not two, but three of this series that was recorded in 2012. So the last three books from the Chronicles of Narnia will be presented, and not just The Horse and His Boy. As before, in the 4th repackage show, Dr. Michael Ward will be my guest, along with Dr. Holly Ordway returning as co-host. Please be sure to listen to the other two re-release shows if you haven't already. There are direct links to them in the show notes. Also in the show notes are links to the separate websites about Planet Narnia, the Narnia Code, and Dr. Michael Ward's personal site. Plus, the notes have a link to Holly Ordway's personal site and the interview I did with her about her autobiography, Not God's Type. You can find the show notes either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast files are hosted directly. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. If you go to the other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, you can still get to this podcast, plus I have a variety of other articles there as well. I hope you enjoyed today's show enough to want to share it. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online and consider listening to other shows. Besides re-releasing this material on the Narnia Code, I also posted a 7-part series with various Lewis scholars examining each Narnia book. And not long ago, I did a podcast honoring the life and legacy of Dr. Bruce Edwards, who suddenly passed away in late October 2015. Again, you can hear those podcasts by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. Also, in case you haven't heard, I have a book coming out in March 2016. It's called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. Learn more about it by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get a free 20-page PDF sample of the book and also pre-order it. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, if you have questions or comments, email them to info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that's info@EssentialCSLewis.com.